Is it time for a mind shift? If you don't know what that means, then join your host, Dr. Clint Haycock, a former evangelical Christian pastor and Bible college teacher of over 20 years, along the journey of deconstruction and reconstruction of faith, life, religion, and spirituality.
My guest this week is Andrew Seidel, constitutional attorney and director of strategic response at the Freedom From Religion Foundation. So thank you, Andrew. Welcome to Mind Shift Podcast.
Thank you for having me on. It's a pleasure.
I've heard you on a couple of different shows. In fact, what really triggered me to reach out to you was recently you were on my friend Chris Shelton's Sensibly Speaking podcast.
Sure.
And Chris and I have been doing a lot of stuff on, of course, he's an ex-Scientologist. I'm an ex-evangelical fundamentalist Christian. I've come out of all of that. That's a whole nother story.
Congratulations. But, it's not an easy thing to do either.
We call ourselves ex-evangelicals or ex-Christians or whatever. I was a pastor. I was a Bible college teacher. I spent all of my life in ministry, academics. I could tell you that's a whole different story, but.
Well, let me ask you a question before we jump in then. Are you familiar with the Clergy Project?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Okay, good. All right, good. Just making sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, good. Good.
I've been out of the church scene for probably 10 or 12 years. But yeah, what I do, though, with my academic side is this is why I do this podcast, is that I do a lot of research. I do a lot of writing, and I've been doing a tremendous amount of stuff on dominion theology and specifically how it relates to the Christian right. And all those kind of things. And I know that's got to be right up your street because you've written this book on Christian nationalism. It's been out, about 2 years now?
No, it's not even a year. It came out in May, mid-May.
Right. Can you tell us briefly what your book is about? Because I know there's this whole thing about the myth of a Christian America and all that. So I'm fascinated to find out what your book is about.
Yeah, I mean, Christian nationalism really seized power in 2016 here in the United States. It was one of the best predictor of a 2016 Trump voter was actually thinking that the United States was founded as a Christian nation. So Trump kind of tapped into this undercurrent of Christian nationalism and then rode it right into the Oval Office. And now his administration is implementing these policies. But the very identity of the Christian nationalist depends on this whole well of lies and myths. Things like we are one nation under God and in God we trust. And the Declaration of Independence references the Christian God four different times, and the founders were all evangelical Christians and they prayed at the Constitutional Convention, and all of our laws are based on the Ten Commandments. Now, without the historical cover those lies give, their policy justifications actually begin to crumble. So what I try to do in the founding myth is undermine that entire identity, destroy that political identity, really, because their political and ideological reality is weak and vulnerable because it's based on all these lies and myths. Now, you mentioned that there have been other books like this, and there have, but other books have kind of addressed the idea about a Christian nation. Ben Gentle, you know, this is what history actually says. Here's what the founders actually meant. Here's what the founders actually said. And they've kind of left it at that, but the correction is not enough, right? We need better arguments. If correction and facts were enough, Donald Trump would not be president. So this book points out those errors, but then it takes the next step. It goes on the offensive because patriotism has no religion. So this book is really an assault on the Christian nationalist identity. Not only are Christian nationalists wrong, their beliefs and identity run counter to the ideals on which this nation was founded. They are un-American. So that's kind of a brief summary of the book. I'd be happy to dig deeper on it. It's your show, man. Let's dive in wherever you want to go.
Well, I've heard you talk about it on a couple of the podcasts. In fact, last night I was just posting up we have a closed Facebook group for our podcast, and I was posting your YouTube video that you did with some of the, I think the president of the FFRF, It was about a year ago, I think. And another woman, she's also on the, she's one of the members of, I can't remember her name, Joyce. I'm trying to think of her name, but anyway, you did a YouTube video. It's an FFRF video. And you talked about the book, this idea that not only is Christian nationalism a myth, as you said, but specifically it's un-American, which goes against what the classic evangelical sort of talking point is, that A, America was a Christian nation, and B, to be American is to be a Christian. To be a Christian is American. American is a Christian. That's just the way it is. But that you're saying that whole foundation is shaky at best, it sounds like.
Yeah, I'm saying that's fundamentally wrong. And you're absolutely right. Their goal is to redefine what it is to be an American. So that to be an American is to be a Christian, and to be a Christian is to be an American. So they're going to redefine America according to the Christian nationalist identity, and then they're going to reshape the law accordingly. That's the goal. And so the way I approach this in the book, you know, if I had to simplify the book down to one question that I was trying to answer, it's this. Did Judeo-Christian principles, whatever they may be, positively influence the founding of the United States of America? And the answer to that question is no, they didn't. That we were not founded on Judeo-Christian principles, and it's a good thing, because those principles, and especially the ones that are central to Christian nationalism, fundamentally conflict with the principles on which the United States was built.
That's it. And you were, I've heard you talking about the Ten Commandments. I think you go over that in the book as well, don't you? You start breaking down, well, first of all, which Ten Commandments? There's multiples. Yeah. You find them in the Old Testament, and there are different iterations of these commandments. And some of them are longer than others, some are shorter than others. But if we actually broke them down commandment by commandment, they're, well, I don't know, what's your take on the Ten Commandments, looking at it now as a constitutional lawyer? I know you're not in favor of saying America must be founded on these, even though they're in courthouses and
they are in
high profile cases of tearing them down and keeping them up.
And actually, that is where this book really started. You know, I was reading an opinion when I was in law school, actually, and one of the Supreme Court justices said something along the lines of, well, of course, the Ten Commandments influenced American law. And I thought, well, that can't be right. I've actually read the Ten Commandments. I know what they say. That can't be right. And so that was where this started. It started out actually as a law review article that just got really out of hand. And, you know, there are, as you mentioned, the first question we have to ask if we're saying the Ten Commandments influenced the American founding is, well, which Ten Commandments? Because there are four sets in any given Bible, Exodus 20, Exodus 34, Deuteronomy 5, and Deuteronomy 27. Now, the set that everybody thinks of as the Ten Commandments, you know, the Charlton Heston coming down off the mountain, smashing the Ten Commandments, those are the Exodus 20 set. They're not called the Ten Commandments in the Bible. That's a different set. Yeah. That's the Exodus 34 set. And that's the set that God promises to commit genocide. He seals that covenant with a pact of genocide and ends those prescriptions with the rule against boiling a kid in its mother's milk. Now that's baby goat kid, not human kid.
A child.
I mean, I think people could be forgiven for making that mistake given what the Old Testament looks like. But the point being, you know, most people don't even understand that. And then there are different translations between different religions and different translations of the Bible, and they number the commandments differently. And it's important to pin people down and say, well, which commandments are you saying influenced the founding of America? Because most people can't do that. Now, if we want to actually investigate, and this is what I do in the book, I walk through the Exodus 20 set, the Charlton Heston set, and compare them to America's founding law, every single one of them. And what you really find is that those are not only un-American, but immoral. I mean, let's just take one example. I mean, first of all, they allow slavery twice, okay? They tacitly allow slavery twice, in the Sabbath commandment and in the coveting commandment. In one of the commandments, the third, depending on which interpretation you're looking at, God promises to punish innocent children. to the third and fourth generation for the crimes of their parents. I mean, that is as terrorism. That's as immoral as you can possibly be.
Yeah.
And that promising to punish innocent children for the crimes of their parents. And let's just start at the beginning. I am the Lord your God. You shall have no other gods before me. That's the first commandment, again, depending on which site you're looking at. That is un-American, right? Mm-hmm. You can have in this country your freedom to worship any god you want or no gods is protected, right? That runs absolutely counter to the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, but it is the first commandment of the Christian God. And so to me, I mean, and we find that conflict, that fundamental disconnect throughout the Ten Commandments.
Well, and as a biblical scholar myself, okay, even though I'm not a Christian anymore, I still studied I studied Greek and Hebrew. I spent a lot of time in seminary studying these ancient languages. And I remember we took a class when I was in seminary where we spent a whole term studying Exodus 20. So we spent an entire term translating the Hebrew text into English as best we could. This is a master's level, you know, Hebrew syntax. We were getting really into this stuff. And we had to read about 600 pages of corollary material in addition to all of our work in the text of the Hebrew. And what I was really asking was, you know, well, I thought that the Ten Commandments not only were the foundation of American law, but, you know, like Western civilization. And what we found was actually there isn't much of a trace, even in Western civilization, because I'm over here in Britain. And of course, the Puritans came mostly from America, or from England, I mean, to America. So they brought all this ideology and theology with them. And you see all this covenant theology and things like that that come. They're looking at America as this promised land. They're like a replacement for Israel. And so many of these talking points are still being repeated today. What I found in studying dominion theology is that it's incredibly pervasive in the mainstream sort of evangelical and even non-evangelical church. Without knowing where these talking points have come from, they just repeat them as, sure, of course America was a Christian nation. Yeah, everyone knows that. I used to think that too until I started reading the Ten Commandments in Hebrew.
I've certainly found that most people haven't spent the time to actually thinking about this. And, you know, there's kind of a simple question that I've asked that kind of undercuts this when people make that claim. It's okay, well, name one principle that's unique or original to Christianity that positively influenced the founding of the United States of America. And I haven't had a good answer to that question yet. I mean, I asked that question in a debate that I had with another author and scholar, a guy named Mark David Hall. That debate was on C-SPAN. He couldn't answer it. Same thing. I mean, I do this repeatedly, and I have not. I'm not saying that answer doesn't exist. I just haven't heard it yet. And the Plymouth and Massachusetts Bay, you know, the Pilgrims and the Puritan story. You know, you're right. It has entered this American mythology in a way that is really interesting because those were failed states for the most part. I mean, they needed rescuing. People hated living there. You know, and I go over a lot of this information in the book. And when the founders were crafting the Constitution, more than 150 years later, too, which I think we all forget that. You know, we look back and we say, oh, well, you know, that was before there was a constitution and it was in America. And we think of that timeline as very compressed, but it wasn't, you know, it was pretty, pretty extensive. So, you know, the founders 150 years later at the Constitutional Convention are looking back at the Puritans and the Pilgrims. And they're saying, look, that's a good idea of what not to make a society look like. We don't want this monochromatic theocracy. We don't want this state power enforcing religious conformity. That's a really, really bad idea, and it doesn't work out well for anyone. We treat these as this, you know, shining examples on a hill to torture a metaphor. Yeah. And really, they're the opposite. They were what not to do.
Well, and historically, what happens when Christians are in fact in charge? I've been writing. I guess it's going to become a book. I started researching dominion theology, kind of like you. I write articles on Medium, and this has gotten utterly out of hand. I think I'm up to about 150 to 200 pages just quotes, and I'm compiling all this information. And that's where the intersection is with your work, is because as I've studied Dominion theology, I've come across guys like David Barton, which I'm sure you're very familiar with. Wall Builders. I heard you guys talking about it on the YouTube video. In fact, I'm looking at their site right now on my iPad. You know, Wall Builders' goal, just reading off their website, is to exert a direct and positive influence in government, education, and the family, you know, by educating the nation concerning the godly foundation of our country. So that's their one of their stated goals, isn't it? They say we're going to promote the forgotten history of America, which is their narrative of the Christian America.
And it's not a forgotten history. It's an alternative history with alternative facts that are
revisionist history.
Yeah, in the Trumpian sense of that word, it is absolutely just not accurate or not true. And you know, you've mentioned Dominionist theology a number of times, and Christian nationalism has massive ties to that. But to me, and what I'm getting at in the book really is, to me, Christian nationalism is not—it's not a scholarly debate, right? This is not something to be studied. This is an existential threat to our republic. It is a political theology that America is in a desperate fight against. And if we do not win, we do not have the Constitution that was written by our founders. It is Christian nationalism is a sinister, exclusionary movement that we have to fight against. So, there are all these really great scholars out there. Andrew Whitehead, who is at the University of Clemson now. I think he's moving up to Indiana somewhere. I mean, Catherine Stewart has a great book coming out called The Power Worshippers on this. I mean, there are a lot of people who've done a really great job of studying the theology and studying the movement and exposing it, which is super important. But what I'm trying to do is say, look, this is not just something we need. We have to fight back against this. And I'm trying to give everybody the tools to do that, the arguments and the facts that they need to arm themselves to do that. And again, I'm an attorney. This is what I do for a living. I argue for a living. And I try to place a lot of emphasis on giving people better arguments, because the facts have been out there for a long time. I mean, the Treaty of Tripoli gets thrown around on social media by everybody all the time. And it is just, it's not an effective argument for our side. And I explain why in this book, and I give people much better arguments to go out there and combat Christian nationalism, because it is absolutely crucial that every person who cares about this is fighting back against it.
Well, and of course, what they're saying is the exact opposite of what you just said. They're framing it as it's a battle for the soul of the nation too. But of course, from their point of view, it's that America is going downhill, and you know, the creeping secularism and homosexuality, same-sex marriage, abortion, blah, 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 blah. And that ties in a lot of it. It ties into that covenant theology, doesn't it? Where the belief system is... Yeah, as these Puritans came across to America, they saw themselves as a replacement for the nation of Israel. America was the promised land. And going back to your example of the Ten Commandments, what everyone seems to fail to recognize is that was part of the covenant that the nation of Israel had with God. That was a theocracy. Those were part of the terms of the covenant. Mm-hmm. It has nothing to do with a modern secular enlightenment nation, which America really was and is, isn't it? Most of these guys were deists. They weren't staunch Christians.
I mean, you're absolutely right, and I kind of get at that a lot. You know, Christian nationalism claims that the United States is exceptional because the nation was chosen, right? Because it has this covenant. But religion did not make the United States, let alone make it great. We the people, and all the implications that come with that phrase, make America great, right? We were the first nation to draft a constitution that not only omitted God, but put all its power, said that the source of its power was we the people. I mean, that was historic. The other thing that the founders did that was, it was really our unique contribution to political thought and political science, right? We separated state and church. Until America, no other government in the history of humanity had sought to protect citizens' right to think freely by divorcing religion and government. And I think we should be proud of that contribution to the world. But Christian nationalists are doing their best to destroy it. So, yeah. I mean, to me, this is really one of the, it is, you know, I think I use that line in the book, actually. I say something like, you know, America is in a fight for its life or its soul, if you prefer. Yeah. I'm not one to use that kind of language because you tend to get misquoted later on in your life. Or
it's in after print now.
Yeah, or after you're dead. You know, I mean, yeah. it really is. It's crucial. And you said another thing that just reminded, you know, you said, you know, most of the founders were deists. And that's one of my favorite conversations to have, right? Like, what did the founding fathers believe? And I always make the joke that, you know, if you give me a glass of something slightly alcoholic or alcoholic and delicious, you know, I will talk about that with you for 8 hours. But it's beside the point, right? Because even if all of the founders were evangelical Christians in the sense that we mean that today, and that they absolutely weren't, it wouldn't prove that they built a nation based on the principles of their religion, right? It does not follow logically. So when our side wades into that argument and says, no, the founding fathers were deists, no, the founding fathers were Christian, that doesn't matter. And we're having an argument that doesn't get us anywhere. And it's an unwinnable argument because it turns into a quote war. And this is one of the things I try to address really, really early on in the book and give people, again, better arguments that they can advance when they are fighting these out with family members, you know, around the holidays, on social media, or when they're encountering it, more importantly, in public policy or in our government.
Hey everybody, we're just going to take a really short break from this conversation between myself and Andrew Seidel talking about Christian nationalism, or I should say the myth of Christian nationalism. Just wanted to say a really brief, quick shout out. Thank you so much to some of our recent Patreon supporters. Want to give a thank you to Doug Ingram, to Grant Warrens, and Sherry Todd as well for being the newest Patreon supporters of this show. Your support is hugely appreciated. One of the cool things, too, is it gives you access, if you're a Patreon supporter, to our closed Mindshift podcast Facebook group. We do a monthly Mindshift Zoom call. And in fact, we just had one last weekend. It was really good. We had about 7 or 8 people drop in. We'll have another one next month with Claudine Gallagher, who was on this podcast last year, and that was really good. We are going to be focusing primarily on exploring this topic of how to deal with the anger that you might feel after coming out of a cult or coming out of a religion. How do you process that? So Claudine is going to be really helpful. So I'm looking forward to having that call with her. So what's coming up in the next couple of weeks in terms of episodes? Well, I've got returning guest Chris Shelton. I just was on his podcast a little bit ago talking about dominion theology, and we got into that. We took a real deep dive into that. So he returned the favor because as an ex-Scientologist, Chris is super knowledgeable about the inner workings, the psychology behind this destructive cult. And so we get into that, had an absolutely fantastic discussion. And then I've got one coming up with Julie Ingersoll after that. She is an expert on Christian Reconstructionism, which if you've been listening to anything I've been doing, I've been talking a lot about dominion theology and now Christian Reconstructionism. We're going to be looking at one of the big things is this issue of Christian homeschooling. What role does Christian Reconstructionism play in Christian education and specifically Christian homeschooling? So I'm really excited to talk to Julie and find out what she knows about that. She's written a book on this subject. She's one of the real leading experts on Christian Reconstructionism and where it goes. You'll probably be surprised at how far this movement, along with dominion theology, has infiltrated not just the mainstream evangelical church in America and the world, but of course, politics, government, schooling, education. It's shocking how pervasive this stuff is. So I'm really looking forward to talking to Julie. I'll just say real briefly before we get back into the chat with Andrew Seidel, how can you get a hold of me? You can follow me on Twitter at MindShift2018. You can also look up the Mindshift Podcast Facebook page. You can get a hold of me in terms of social media. Those are probably the two best platforms, either Twitter or Facebook. And so that's how you can find me. Also, just one last favor I want to ask. If you believe this show deserves a good rating, please head over to iTunes. Give this show the star ranking that you think this show deserves. Tell your friends about it. Tweet it out. share it on social media, get the word out, help people to understand what is going on in their world today, not just in terms of Christian Reconstructionism and all that, but Christian nationalism, the cults. That's what I've been working on. So let's get back into this chat with Andrew Seidel as we dig deeper into the myth of Christian nationalism. Well, and it's important too to point out as well, as you're saying, even if they were evangelical Christians in the sense of a guy like Tony Perkins, a family research counselor, Dr. James Dobson, someone like that, why did that, what they believe is, how is that still binding for us today? That's the one thing I was listening to. I'm sure you're familiar with, it's a radio show called Stand in the Gap Radio. I don't know if you've heard of these guys, but
I have heard it.
His name is Sam Rohr. He was a former, I think, congressman, representative. He does all sorts of things, goes all over the country and talks. He does this radio podcast, Stand in the Gap Radio, and he had David Barton on there. And I thought, all right, I'm going to listen to this on the way to work because I want to find out what David, where he's coming from. And what really struck me was, as they were talking about the forgotten history of America, everything was couched in this covenant theology language. And they were essentially saying, in so many words, because that's what the Puritans believed, that's somehow still binding for us today. That because I thought to myself, I know they really did believe it. They did. I've studied Puritan theology. I studied Jonathan Edwards. But just because Jonathan Edwards believed it, or so, why is that binding on me and you today? Who cares what they believed 250, 300 years ago? Why is that somehow binding still?
It's an excellent question. It's an excellent question. You know, I mean, you're touching on an even broader point there that I think is worth looking at. You know, what they are really asking to do, what they're really yearning for, is to regress. They don't want to go back to some golden age. They want to go back to a time when religion ruled the world. And, you know, as Ruth Green famously quipped, when religion ruled the world, it was called the Dark Ages, right? And that's really what they're looking to do. They're trying to go back to this time where Christianity was wedded to the secular government power and could use that power to enforce conformity. And what you're seeing now, we're in this really fascinating point because demographics are shifting rapidly away from Christianity here in America. And I think that's one of the reasons that you're seeing such vocal and violent opposition from the Christian nationalists, right? So as America nears the tipping point at which Christianity's power and privilege are reduced to equality, the Christian nation myths are going to be trumpeted more and more and more. The Christian nationalist is not going to go gently into the obsolescence for which they are bound, right? They are accustomed to religious privilege. They are used to imposing their beliefs on the unsuspecting school children. They expect politicians to pay lip service to their God. They demand acknowledgments of their God as government property.
Yeah, Mike Pence is holding, they're holding worship and prayer meetings in the White House right now.
Bible studies tomorrow, in
Congress.
Don't get started on the White House Bible study. I mean, tomorrow, Donald Trump is issuing guidance on prayer in public schools, which is almost certainly going to warp what the law says. White House Bible study, which you mentioned, is a perfect example of Christian nationalism.
Yeah.
And it's how they justified the child separation policy at the border. Most people forget this. They cited Romans 13 to justify that policy, which was actually
Jeff Sessions.
And it was incidentally the same theology that Britain and the loyalist preachers in the United States were using to say that the United States could not rebel and have the American Revolution and become an independent country back in 1776. Mm-hmm. You know, the time of that privilege and power, Christianity's privilege and power, is ending. Right, the end of Christian privilege is near. But it really is up to people to fight back. Outspoken resistance is, this is a quote I love, James Madison said, it's the first duty of citizens. And right now, Christian nationalists have persuaded too many Americans to abandon our heritage, to spurn our secular foundations in favor of their myth. But we invented the separation of state and church. It's an American original. And it's time to reclaim that heritage and bury their lies.
But of course, what we're seeing is what you said. We're seeing, it's weird because these evangelicals that are on the evangelical advisory board of Trump's, and a lot of them are Dominion theologians. What they want is they want a semi-permeable wall. They want they don't want the state to interfere in the church. What's in their terminology, they say that's government overreach into your private lives and your religious freedoms and all the rest of it. But what they want is they don't want any barrier from their side into the government.
They want a one-way wall, which is not something that exists, right? Like Jefferson chose the wall metaphor for a reason, and the Supreme Court adopted it in, you know, if you listen to people like David Barton, they tell you that the Supreme Court adopted it recently, but they actually adopted it back in 1878, and it's been readopted and mentioned, you know, at least 40 or 50 times since then by Supreme Court and circuit courts. I mean, that metaphor is really useful for us.
Well, and the dangers, like you were saying, why is Christian nationalism dangerous? When I there's just been two or three things that have happened in the last, since the end of December. One was the Christianity Today article that came out on the 22nd of December. Then there was a huge backlash. There was this open letter. I don't know if you read that, but it was over 200 evangelical leaders wrote this response. Now, what I started doing was I started researching, because as soon as I read those signatories, about 10 names immediately jumped out at me, because I've been studying Dominion theology, and I'm like, okay, he's a Dominionist, she's a Dominion. I knew these people. I knew who they were. And I'm like, why are they signing this letter? What's that about? I started researching that. Then, of course, there was the January the 3rd, there was the Trump rally at a church in Miami. I mean, that was
El Rey Jesus,
But Maldonado, pastor, he is a known Dominion theologian. He's a New Apostolic Reformation pastor. So there's a connection there.
He speaks in tongues.
Yeah.
He speaks in tongues. He's a faith healer. I don't know if you know this. He has forced hurricanes to reroute themselves with his prayers.
Right. Of course he has.
And, you know, it's alarming. That alignment is very alarming.
Exactly.
I'll get to that.
Well, and they've got Trump's ear. That's the thing, isn't it? And I read an article on the Americans United website, and they were saying the real scary part about the Trump Evangelical Advisory Board is that, first of all, they're not publishing any announcements of when they meet. So we don't know when they're meeting. And then second, they're not keeping any minutes of those meetings. We don't know what the fuck they're talking about. But what we can see is when Trump tweets out some policies, like, for example, when he tweeted out that trans people were no longer going to be allowed in the American military, they found out they had been discussing that just shortly before in this evangelical board meeting. And they were pressuring Trump to do that, and he did. So there's a clear example of that dangerousness, as you were talking about, of Christian nationalism, Dominion theology, evangelicalism, influencing public policy right now.
Yeah, I mean, it's happening all over. The child separation policy is another example. Yeah. The Muslim ban. A lot of people forget.
Abortion laws that came out last year in those various states, those really strong laws. They're trying to overturn Roe versus Wade, aren't they? That's what they're and they knew a lot of those laws were going to be shot down. Well, there's Project Blitz,
They want those. They want those laws to be shot down. Like I hate to do this to listeners. The whole goal is to get those laws shot down and get the challenge to the Supreme Court, which they believe will overturn Roe versus Wade. And I mean, that could actually happen this term in the next few months. Mm-hmm. I hate to say this. I hate to predict this, but I think it's very likely that Roe versus Wade is going to be gone in the next 3 years.
And they'll be ecstatic. That ties into the covenant theology, because in their view, God is angry with America because we are allowing abortion and same-sex marriage. If we can reverse that, God will start blessing us again. You know, so it just it ties right back into that covenant thinking.
It really does.
That's what they're trying to do.
And, you know, again, they're basing all of that, not the theology, but all of the public policy push and certainly all of their communications, their public relations on all these lies and myths about American history that we really have a duty to push back against. And if we can push back against those, it destroys their policy justifications as well as destroying possibly their entire political identity. I mean, and that is what I am out to do.
You're out to do. You're not making any bones about it. And of course,
I am
again,
out to destroy Christian nationalism. I need all the help I can get. Yeah.
Well, if I can help you in any way get the word out, I'm more than happy to do that. Because of course, you're the enemy. You're the guy that they're talking about. I was researching the Alliance Defending Freedom, which is essentially, as far as I can tell, it's the exact counterpart to the FFRF. They're the ones that are defending, again, people like, you know, the people, the evangelicals who refuse to bake a cake for a same-sex marriage or wedding. They're going to the courts and fighting these sorts of battles, all that, you know, and you guys are kind of doing the exact opposite.
And just to give you an idea of what we're up against, I mean, it is a David and Goliath story, really. I mean, the 2018 budget for the Alliance Defending Freedom was $55 million, which is, I mean, that's 10 or 11 or 12 or 13 times what FFRF's budget is. They have 35 to 40 lawyers on their staff, and then they have a cooperating attorney network of something like 2,000. This is a massive organization. You put all the groups like FFRF and on FFRF's side together, and we aren't that big. And so we really do need a lot of help. The good news is, I know that's probably scary to a lot of people, the good news is we're right. And not only are we right, but we're also winning. We're winning in the courts, though I expect that to change as Trump continues to poison the court system. But more importantly, and I say this to people all the time, we're never going to win this fight in the courts, really. We're going to win this fight with demographics. And the demographics are absolutely shifting in our favor. We are going to win that fight. So,
and we're seeing a lot of people think, okay, this is the last gasp of evangelicalism, fundamentalism, dominionism, whatever you want to call it. They know that because, I was listening to an episode of Stand in the Gap. They had Stephen Strang on, who's the founder of Charisma Magazine, Charisma Media. And he said that they were talking about the Trump vote in 2020, and they asked him, what's at stake in 2020? And he said, it is everything's on the line. It's all or nothing for evangelicals. If he doesn't get reelected, basically we are screwed. We are totally 100% screwed. You know, you have to vote for Trump. And they said, do we have a choice? And he said, no, we don't have a choice. That's how stark it is.
That wraps up kind of everything we've been talking about in a bow. You know, I mean, even going back to the Puritans and the Pilgrims, the reason they want Trump and the reason they want that type of government is because they want to use the machinery of the state to impose their religion on everybody else, right? The goal is to stem the demographic tide that is fleeing Christianity and use the machinery of the state to enforce conformity. That is the end goal. The end goal is theocracy. It's 1984. That's what we're battling against. They're not going to win, but that's why they want an ally or a useful idiot or a puppet, whatever phrase you want to use, like Trump in the White House, who will do the evangelical, the Christian nationalist bidding.
Absolutely. Well, in that open letter, in my article on Medium, I said they gave away the whole game because what they said was, the reason we're supporting Trump is he's delivering on our agenda. And I'm like, there it is. That's as bald as you can state it. That's what they said. You know, and they went through judges, and they did it right
at the beginning of the rally shortly after that. When they you know, I've heard the allusion, the analogy between Trump and Cyrus from evangelicals before, but they said it with Trump on stage to him. At the beginning of that rally, you know, that they're saying, like, he's basically, they're saying he's a bad dude, but he's doing the right thing for us. So we're going to go
Cyrus ahead and
go with
and all that. Yeah. He's God's prophetically chosen man. He's the disruptor. He's the God's chaos candidate, on and on and on. That's the stuff I'm researching, people like Lance Wall now and other people, and they're teaching Bible studies in Congress right now.
Well, they are. And this This may irritate you just because you're so, you understand the theology and you're so deep in and deeply immersed in it and studying it. But one thing that I would encourage everybody to do, at least when you're messaging on this stuff publicly, when you're talking about it, is not worry about the differences between dominionism and seven mountain dominionism and theocrats and theocracies and evangelicals, and stick to the phrase Christian nationalist or Christian nationalism.
It's more helpful.
It's really a lot more helpful, and it encompasses the problem with this identity right off the bat. And people can understand it, not just at an intellectual level, but at a gut level too. Morning Consult, a polling outfit, did a study, I think it was, I want to say last April, and they found that 48% of the country thought that Christian nationalism was a real threat to the United States of America. Wow. And I talked with the authors of that study, and I said, you know, what were the numbers before Donald Trump? Because that's what I want to know what the increase is. And they said, we didn't even know to ask the question before Donald Trump. Nobody knew what Christian nationalism was. So, you know, I mean, this is something that everybody can understand. Hmm. You know, if you say, look, there's a seven mountain dominionist teaching a Bible study to the U.S. Congress, they're like, okay. But if you say there's a Christian nationalist teaching...
Yeah.
You know, that has a much different flavor to it. People can understand at a gut level what's wrong with it. So I try to encourage everybody, you know, and there's all those fun terms that people like to throw around, like Christo-fascist and Talibangelical and all that stuff. Yeah. Stop it. It's fun. Go with Christian nationalist. It's not helping. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. I know you have to get going. So just as we close then, how can people find you on Twitter? Is that your favorite sort of platform,
all the interwebs.
You're there.
I'm Andrew at Andrew L. Seidel on Facebook, on Twitter, on Instagram. I would really encourage people to, you know, the Freedom From Religion Foundation is ffrf.org. We are on the front lines of this fight. We have 30,000 members, and we depend on your membership dues to do the work of fighting Christian nationalism. But it's not just, you know, it's important for us to have members for a bigger reason, not just for the money, which is obviously crucial, but we need people to join their voices with ours. Because when we write a letter to Mike Pompeo or Donald Trump, or when we go into a congressional office and we're able to say that we represent 30 people or 300 or 3,000 or where we are right now, 30,000, right? That is powerful. And the more people who join their voices with ours by becoming members, the more influence and impact we can have. So I really encourage everybody to join FFRF. It's only $40 a year. And I mean, it's a small price to pay when you consider the damage that the Trump administration
absolutely
has done to this country.
So beyond reading your book, people should join the FFRF, support the work that you guys are doing. It's really important work, isn't it? And I find it hugely ironic as an ex-evangelical to say that only because, you know, 15, 20 years ago, you'd have been my enemy.
I know, yeah. You know, not have liked it.
And guys like you provide that fodder for people to say, see, they're the ones trying to tear down all the good work and God's kingdom and all the rest of it. But now it's like, wow, that is super important. Absolutely. So thank you for the work you're doing. Thank you for putting this book out there. Thank you for talking to me, spending some time out of your busy day.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Thank you for having me on. I really, really appreciated the conversation.
Yes, thank you, Andrew. I will speak to you later. Take care.
All right, bye-bye.